So is this on already? Yep. Am I good to go? Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. I appreciate you inviting me to be here with you and giving me the opportunity, me and my family, the opportunity to worship with you and get to know you, at least to start that process. So what I thought I would do this morning is try to tie in the class and the sermon. So we're going to look at the Sermon on the Mount, at least a particular aspect of the Sermon on the Mount in our class, and then we'll try to tie some things into that in our sermon. All right. I want you to be honest about what comes to mind when you hear some of these scenarios I'll list. Let's say you imagine yourself. I've never been to Jerusalem. Anybody ever been to Jerusalem? No? Okay. I haven't been, but I know people who've been there, so I hear stories from them. Jerusalem is quite a mixture of different people. It's not only, you know, Jews who live there, but it's Jews and Muslims and then various, you know, denominations of Christians who live there together, all in the same city. And, of course, other, you know, mixes in there as well. But there's... with, you know, all religions are divided up, you know, different points of emphasis and disagreements on how to understand their, you know, their scriptures and all that sort of thing. So Judaism's the same way, but certain portions of Jews, Orthodox Jews and ultra-Orthodox Jews, have set prayer times throughout the day. There's three times during the day that they would pray, and they pray out loud, and actually... that's carrying forward what we see in the Bible. You know, may not be aware of this, but everybody in the Bible prayed out loud. Right? There was silent prayer was really uncommon, at least what we see in the scriptures. So when it's time for prayer, wherever they are, they will say their formal prayers. So if they're in the middle of a marketplace, so imagine yourself in a bustling marketplace, people all over, you know, bustling and jostling, getting to, you know, one stand to the next, one store to the next. Time for prayer in the middle of the day, and you see this guy just raise his hands and start praying out loud while everybody's moving around him. Why do you think that person's doing it that way? Or, you know, with Muslims, they have also set prayer times during the day in certain places around the world, including in our country. Wherever they are, they get their prayer mat out and they pray toward Mecca. If it's in the middle of the street, it's in the middle of the street. Traffic has to stop. Why do you think that person is doing that in that way? Why can't they get, you know, do you think, just go to the sidewalk. Just stand over out of the way and stop drawing attention to yourself. Anybody think that?
If I was stopped in traffic, I probably would. you know, when it comes to the Orthodox Jews, you got to figure it's one of two things. Either they really are that dedicated, and this is what they think God's will is for them to do, and so they're going to do it regardless of what anybody thinks, mm-hmm. which there's nothing wrong with that line of thinking, you know, or they are doing it to be seen. And with that type of culture, obviously, if we were in the middle of Walmart and we saw that happen in our culture, that would be very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
To see somebody just start shouting the prayer or to put their prayer mat down and start preaching or praying in the middle of the aisle of Walmart, that mm-hmm. would be very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But in that culture in Jerusalem, it's probably such an everyday, commonplace thing that it's to the point now that no one even pays attention.
Yeah.
You know, this guy guy's going to start saying his prayer, and that's just that time of day. You know, you can almost set your watch. It's that time of day. So they go and do that, you know. Mm-hmm. You just walk around it, and you cope because that's the culture.
Yeah. So what if we were watching a football game on TV, and then we see a player come out with a scripture on his eye black, or after a touchdown he kneels. Now, why is he doing it? Why is he doing it that way? He knows there's cameras on him, right? Yes, sir.
It's hard for us to say what each individual's got in their heart. I mean, mm-hmm. If either they're really trying to praise God for everything that he's led them, or there he could be doing it. It's not for us really to judge what he's for or how he's doing it.
Yeah. All right. Very well said. And I guess we just end the class early. You said where I want us to go. How about that? Let me just put the billboard up. But when we come to the Sermon on the Mount, I want us to first look at Matthew chapter 6. And I want us to do two things this morning. We want to look, first of all, at what Jesus says, and you know, look at what he actually says. And then we want to put this in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, which is the way Matthew's recorded it and the way it's been divided up for us is three chapters long, right? And so this is part of exercise in context, keeping things in context, in immediate context or broader context. So Matthew chapter 6, verses... let's see, we'll start with verses 1 through 6. So Matthew 6, verses 1 through 6. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Notice how Jesus puts this together for us. And some Bible translations will help us see this by paragraph divisions. Just as an aside, paragraph divisions are important to have in a Bible. One reason is because this is how we think in our culture and in Western culture in general. Matthew, when he actually wrote this, there wasn't paragraph divisions. It was all just straight lines from beginning of the book to the end. But there are groups of thought that need to be connected together, need to be seen. And sometimes they're like what we have here in Matthew 6 is sort of a heading saying, here's a summary of what I'm going to say. I'm going to give some examples. So verse 1 is sort of a summary of the next 17 verses. So going through verse 18. What is the smallest unit of thought? Anybody know what the smallest unit of thought is? It cannot be any smaller than a complete sentence. Okay. Smallest unit of a thought cannot be smaller than a complete sentence. Now, depending on context, a complete sentence can be one word. But context will make that clear. If it's longer than one word, you have to pay attention to everything that's in the sentence. And sometimes with this kind of statement, we can ignore parts of the sentence that actually are crucial to the complete thought that Jesus is conveying. Everybody follow me? I'll explain here with verse 1. So what's the warning in verse 1? Beware of what? Right. Yeah. So what Jesus says is, he's not saying don't pray in public, right? Everybody agree with that? Else we're violating this every time we worship together. And Jesus himself would violate it because he prayed in public, right? Go to John 11 when he raises Lazarus from the dead. He prays on purpose for the people around him to hear. So he's not saying don't pray in public. He's saying, be aware of your reasons, your motivations, right? It's in order to be seen by them, in order to be seen by people. And then he's consistent in that with all of these examples. This comes up in every example that he gives. So notice in verse 2, the reason why the Jewish leaders, at least some of the Jewish leaders, make an ordeal about giving to the needy is for what reason? At the end of verse 2.
So they can be praised by others.
Right, so they'd be praised by others. So it's not truly or merely or only altruistic, to benefit someone in need. It's to benefit themselves by the recognition, right? It's look at what I'm doing and how great I am, how righteous I am, right? And then we see the same thing when their prayers. Why do they stand? Why do they love to, in verse 5, why do they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners? That they may be seen by men, right? You see, there's a pattern here, and the complete thought must be their motivation for doing something. And then we didn't read verses 16 through 18, but that's about fasting. And if you jump down to verse 16, you see the same pattern, the same emphasis. The reason why they draw attention to them fasting is for what reason? Right, to be seen by others. Yeah.
The same thing that he mentions there in verse 7 is about, or verse 7 and 8 too, that when even the prayers themselves, you might use big words, and like he says, lofty phrases for the same thing.
Yeah.
Just to be seen by others.
Right. Mm-hmm. And have you ever heard someone say this? Say this passage on praying in verses 5 through 6. Jesus is saying, don't say long prayers. Don't say long prayers in public. Right, that's just a blanket statement. Keep your prayers short. Now, is that what Jesus is saying? No. Again, there's nothing in and of itself that's wrong with long prayers in public, right? But, I mean, there's other reasons why we may want to keep prayers short in a public setting, a public worship setting, right? What might that be? What are some good reasons to keep, to not pray for 10 minutes, at least a typical worship service, like we tend to do. Yes, ma'am?
I think a lot of times the long prayers that you hear in church, and I think, why can't I pray that? I don't know how to do this. Someone's going to have to teach me how to pray. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's
insightful.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. There could be some self-doubt, that could affect me when I leave here. I'd be discouraged to pray to God or to lead a prayer in public. Yeah. And you said, maybe something like kind of lose your train of thought when you're listening to somebody. Your mind will wander. So there's other good reasons, right, to not just go on and on in leading a public prayer. But is Jesus addressing those concerns? No. Right? And that's okay. Right? The Bible doesn't have to do that for us. We can use biblical wisdom to make wise choices like that. Like, let's keep prayer short for the benefit of everybody else. It's going to be more edifying. People can keep up with us. Right? Yes, sir?
You have to define what short and long is, too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Sometimes, you know, 10-minute prayer may be absolutely necessary for the needs of the congregation.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And then other times, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
But then talk about a 30-minute prayer, now you're putting everybody to sleep.
Yeah.
You know? So you got, like you said, you got to use wisdom and make the right decisions.
Right. That's a very good point. Well said. So I've heard some say, you know, just as a blanket statement, don't say long prayers because Jesus says not to. And I've heard some who say that themselves every time they lead a public prayer, it's almost word for word the same every time. Right? Well, then doesn't Jesus have something to say about, you know, vain repetition? But is that person vainly repeating those words because he says the same thing every time? Yeah, I'm going to assume he's, you know, I can't read his heart, as this brother Lloyd said. This is the way he prays. This is where he's at. And I'm going to assume it's heartfelt and he's genuine. Now, I could say it maybe not be the most edifying for everybody else, but we want to practice other biblical teaching, you know, patience and sympathetic kind of understanding of where people are in their walk with the Lord. Now, we want to take this to so we've looked at the sort of immediate context, what Jesus says, right, in these complete sentences. It's always about the person wanting to draw attention to himself. And we've established, or at least we seem to be in agreement, how do we know when somebody's doing that? Well, we don't know for sure just by looking at what somebody does outwardly, right? So there's a big difference here. Sometimes the most we can miss the most obvious differences here. How do I know Jesus is right about the Pharisees, but I'm not sure I'm right about someone else who's drawing attention to themselves in some way, leading a public prayer? Or yes.
Well, Jesus knows the heart.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, that's just into the class for me. Yeah, I got there. Yeah.
When you think about what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 13:7, when he was defining love, he says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. And I think part of the thought that's being taught there is, and the idea of believing all things, is giving your brethren whom you love the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. Always assume the best. You know, sometimes, regardless of what circumstance we may see, the first thing we do is jump to a negative conclusion about what we've just seen.
Yeah.
Rather than giving the brother that you're supposed to love the benefit of the doubt until you know differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whether it's their intentions when they're praying or giving or whatever, you give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, you love that brother and you sincerely appreciate what they've said or done until you know differently that there was a different motive.
Yeah, right. We have some concrete evidence. Yeah, there's a different motive, yeah. That's really well said. And I think that's exactly where Jesus is taking us through this. So moving into a broader context here, I want to compare a couple of other passages from the Sermon on the Mount with Matthew 6 so that we can see now the point that was made for us by both Kevin, Lloyd, and what was your name again? Dave.
Dale.
Dale. Okay, Dale. And really, I really appreciate your comment, Dale, because you're spot on. And Jesus is going to take us there. And I'll show you how here. I was going to use it. My handwriting is awful, so if you can't read this, well, I won't be surprised. If I try to correct it, you know, it just won't get any better. So we'll kind of put Matthew 6 here. Let's say is that visible somewhat with Matthew? That's a 5. And then we'll look at Matthew 7 here. Because we have to kind of keep things together here. And, you know, with a long sermon like the Sermon on the Mount, which probably isn't as long as most of the sermons I preach, just moving from one topic to another, we can kind of get lost and not keep things together. This is one of the more well-known passages from the Sermon on the Mount. So if we go back to chapter 5 and look at verses 13 through 16. So Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. This is at the beginning of the sermon. And here is, how does Jesus open up the sermon? What's the first thing? What's those list of things that at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount? The Beatitudes. And what's striking about this is this is sort of like a, I was going to say a punch to the gut. That's not the right expression. It's unexpected and shocking the way he opens a sermon. How would you or I describe a citizen in God's kingdom? I wouldn't start where Jesus does. It's, you know, the poor in spirit. Somebody who's broken and they know it. They're aware of it. That's a person in God's kingdom. Well, it's not the strong and the mighty. In other words, he's already saying the Jewish leaders generally, that's not the model. We're not setting a good model for citizenship in God's kingdom. But then he gives this description with these 8 Beatitudes. And then he says, if this is you, you're going to be persecuted for it. So blessed are those who are persecuted. And then he says, here is your role. This is your purpose, your mission for God's kingdom is to be the salt of the earth. You are the salt of the earth. This is who you are as a Christian, as a citizen, you know, of course, you know, post the cross, we would say a Christian, a disciple of Jesus. This is who you are. Your identity is the salt of the earth. And then in verse 14, switches metaphors and says, you're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. So what Jesus says about the light of the world, compare this with these public acts of religion, these public acts of service to God. Does Jesus say that other people need to see that we're devoted to God? Yeah. Right, and so what does that look like? Well, you know, it depends on what it is. But I'm going to reiterate what's already been said. Just because we can see something externally doesn't tell us much about the person's motivation. Right. What if it's a song leader who's got a? I'll give a comparison. This is a story someone told me. I wasn't there for this, but it was a singing, you know, of hundreds of people at some church in another state. And song leader was leading, "I'm the one," you know, "I'm the one who shouted crucify." And when he would say, "I'm the one," he beat his chest, right, as he's conducting. And the person who told me this story thought he was kind of showboating, just because he beat his chest. Now, well, how do I make that judgment?
You can't make that judgment.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's sincere. He is actually feeling a bit of anguish over the result of his sin. Yeah, he can be expressed that way. But what if somebody has a kind of a modest expression on their face as they're leading, singing? It's not drawing attention to themselves in some undue way. Maybe they're really good leading, singing, and they know it. Can they? Now, I'm not making any judgment about anybody here. I'm saying, in the realm of possibility, could that person say, "I know I'm really good at this. That's why I'm up here." Yeah. How? And I will never know that. Right? Yes, Mr. Dale?
In any culture, mm-hmm. whether it's our culture, whether it's wherever in the world, anything that is deviates from what that culture sees as normal, mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So very good, good point. Very well said. This is something that I've seen where we're not, at least some brothers and sisters in the Lord I know aren't aware of the things like cultural differences, and what we're nitpicking are those cultural differences. It's not necessarily an act in and of itself that's wrong. It's just different. Yeah, and that can be challenging for us to begin to understand and kind of see it for ourselves if we haven't been confronted with it. Yes, sir.
I wish Jesse was here this morning. He's sick and he's not able to be in our class, but mm-hmm. I'm sure he would, and he's shared with us before, that when him and his wife moved to England for a year, that worship services were a lot different than they are here because mm-hmm. of the cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And of course, when Brother Jerry would go overseas to a variety of places, the same mm-hmm. thing, it wasn't unusual when he was in the middle of a sermon for two or three dogs to just come into the yeah. building and just lay down in front of the podium.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a different culture. And the people there completely were oblivious to that.
Yeah.
That was the way of life. Mm-hmm. But for us, we think, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
The dog came in there and lay down in front of the podium.
Yeah. So let's use these examples here. How can people see our light shine? It's, avoid, right? We want to be aware of judgments we're making that aren't grounded in some, concrete evidence or moral right or wrong issue, right? And by being seeking understanding from other people, not just coming out and with a judgmental heart, letting that be expressed in our words and actions, but showing love to one another when we have these kind of big differences, cultural differences, and we come from even us in the same country, the same region, come from different backgrounds, right? We bring all this stuff with us when we come to Christ, and then we've got to start the process of working through all that. Well, this, you know, practicing of love, and I'll go ahead and jump in here to Matthew 7, and that is self-reflection first, self-examination first. That's letting our light shine before men when we, you know, basically love each other, and we let that show. We're not nitpicking and expressing ourselves in judgmental ways, because people will pick, even if it's subtle, people will pick up on it, and if it's obvious, then it won't be missed. See, do we go to 10:20? So we got about 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. So another way to let our light shine, and again, we want to, where what Jesus addresses here can kind of creep in, is this long list of moral issues that Jesus covers for throughout the rest of chapter 5. All right, so Jesus moves into the next section of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, verses 17 through 48, is about the righteousness of the Pharisees. Your righteousness needs to surpass the righteousness of the Pharisees. Now, what Jesus is not doing, that some historically and some still today would make this claim, is that he's saying, here's this impossibly high standard, and I need you to see you cannot achieve this, you can't reach it, so it will, you know, crush your heart, humble you to just accept Jesus' forgiveness on the cross and, you know, receive his righteousness that way. It's his righteousness that will elevate you. Jesus isn't doing that. He's not talking about the imputation of righteousness here. He's not talking about this is only for a future millennium. Some, you know, argue that. He's saying this is the kingdom of God presently. Now, of course, we're not going to be perfect here, and he's going to get there with Matthew 7 and other biblical teaching. Even I would suggest in Matthew would say we're not going to be perfect until the resurrection, right? But in the meantime, we can be faithful to Jesus' teaching, even if it's, you know, our obedience is imperfect, and our obedience is imperfect this side of the resurrection. So I'm just saying what is these are unspoken assumptions here in the Sermon on the Mount, and these same kinds of things are in all the New Testament letters. Right, the same kind of teaching is going on. So he moves on, say, your righteousness needs to surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees. And then the first thing he first sort of example issue he addresses in verses 21 and following is what?
Anger.
Yeah, so anger. And he's comparing and contrasting anger with what? What's the extreme that anger can lead to?
Murder,
right? Somebody said murder. So we know murder is wrong. Just don't murder, don't murder. But we may, you know, on this spectrum, back up, you know, a little bit. But then we'll get to a point where we say, basically, the sin that leads to murder, that it's okay back here. Right? That's kind of what the Pharisees were saying. What Jesus is saying here, here's the correct way to understand what we call the Old Testament. He's not correcting the Old Testament, which is a common misunderstanding of the Sermon on the Mount. He's correcting the traditions of the scribes and Pharisees. You read in the Old Testament, clearly it addresses the problem of anger. If you ever read the book of Proverbs, right? This is nothing brand new. It's just the traditions of the elders have overruled otherwise clear teaching in the scriptures. Now, let's say, all right, I get it, Jesus. I need to not just be aware of the potential for me to lose my anger in a sinful way, but if there's a problem between me and a brother, I need to go reconcile with my brother, right? Let's say I do that. Can that lead to a temptation to pride? Like, well, look at me. Look at how good I am. I forgive so easily. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've heard people give examples of how humble they are. And I'm serious.
Yeah.
In a very boisterous, way, bragging about the fact that they are so humble, and they would give an example of their humility. And that kind of, that kind of rubs you the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's hard to appreciate that humility when it's presented in such a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, do you get the idea that on the one hand we need to let our reconciliation be known, like we don't want to hide it, right? When there's some problem and then we work through it, and we reconcile, there's true forgiveness. We don't want to, hide that because we think that's what we're supposed to do. That's one of the things that will draw people to Christ. Is when there is a problem and we work through it. Because, frankly, that's what's not happening out, in the world. People don't experience that. And really deep down, they want something like that. Right? So if they see our good deeds, that can draw them to Christ and they can glorify God. Yes, sir?
Well, another family that's not able to be here this morning is the Benwares. Mm-hmm. Ben has shared with us before how him and his wife were very worldly. Mm-hmm. They had no religious background, really. And a neighborhood they lived in had a Christian family, I think, either right next door or across the street. And he just began to see their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not grow up in that kind of home.
Mm-hmm.
And that really appealed to him. And when they ended up inviting him to worship, that was the beginning for him.
Mm-hmm.
He saw a whole different way of life that he was very attracted to.
Yeah.
And they ended up, of course, obeying the gospel and becoming faithful Christians. But it all started with them not seeing someone that was boasting, look how righteous I am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But someone who was just living the life of a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that had an influence on him.
Yeah. And that's really being the light of the world. And that's, so it's important, to pay attention to our personal relationships, to the kind of things Jesus goes on to exemplify, the marriage relationship, or our friends, our enemies, how we think about them, how we treat them, react to them. But that doing that can also be a source of temptation to say, well, look how good I am, right? And that can be a turnoff, right? That can be doing things for the recognition of people. And so all this leads to is what Jesus makes more explicit in chapter 7, right? So turn to Matthew 7 and those first five verses. Again, this may be among the most well-known verses out of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7 verse 1 is probably the most well-known Bible verse, even among unbelievers, but it's often misunderstood. But Jesus says in Matthew 7, verse 1, judge not that you be not judged, for with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is the log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. And what I tend to do is, read this passage and say, is Jesus saying, don't ever make a judgment about anything, right? So no, and that's really, should be almost self-evident. I hope I'm not kind of oversimplifying that, but it's impossible not to make a judgment call about anything. But what he's talking about here is self-reflection, which is kind of, what we've been saying anyway in our comments. And so we kind of keep these things in together. And this will help me look back here on Jesus' teaching on public religious activities and my role as a salt and light person in the world, and you know, my moral growth and maturity as a Christian. This has to be married to self-reflection and self-examination, and it's the reason why this is such a big deal. Why I'm making a big deal about this is because this could be one of the most helpful areas to be salt and light in the world, in our cultural setting today. Because what, generally speaking, it's common for non-Christians who don't have familiarity with the Bible, maybe they didn't grow up in church, maybe they did, whether, you know, whatever denomination it may be, and they think of Christians as a bunch of self-righteous hypocrites. In other words, they don't do what Jesus says in Matthew 7. What their sort of initial reaction is, condemning everything they don't like or disagree with, and there's no, you know, inward inspection of their own heart, right? Yeah.
If I was in my teens Bible class, I would be having them right next to Matthew 7:1. I'd have them right in there Matthew 22:39, which is love your neighbor as yourself, because it's saying use the same kind of judgment that you would want people to use towards yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's something we don't do. We tend to, again, jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. And if you just ask yourself, if I was in that situation, would I want people to be thinking that about me? Mm-hmm. And if you loved your neighbor as yourself, that would not happen. You would be using righteous judgment. And you would reflect on the fact that, okay, I'm going to be judged the way I'm judging someone else. So I've got to be careful what I'm thinking, what I say to other people, because that same line of thinking is going to be used against me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. It's, and this is really in my understanding of things. Really, one of the fundamental aspects of Christianity is doing this kind of work within oneself. I mean, this is part of our growth as Christians. The fruit of the Spirit kind of grows out of this kind of thing too. And if I want somebody to know Christ, you know, I'm going to turn them off if I'm judgmental. If I'm conveying to them, I'm not sympathetic. I'm not even trying to understand where you are, where you're coming from, right? And they will sense that, and that's a major obstacle in our cultural setting today. And this kind of self-reflection, like, you know what, I do struggle with pride in some area, right? I do struggle with this temptation that is more evident in this person. Maybe that it's expressed in a different way, but mine is not as obvious. So I can relate, right? I can relate to where this person's coming from. And oh, by the way, the only reason I'm forgiven is because of Jesus, and the same is true of them, right? The only reason they'll be forgiven is because of Jesus. So we have the same, you know, position, basically. Our link is to life is Jesus, or link to God is Jesus. it's not all the things I do right versus all the things that person does wrong. Does that make sense? And what I find within myself when I am honest about even my motives, there's usually kind of a mixture. There's usually not 100% pure motive, pure motivation to do things for the right reason. Sometimes there's a mixture. Even when I want to do things for the right reason, but sometimes there's something else going on too, right, that's kind of mixed in there that's sinful. Like, I want to receive something out of this. I want that isn't just purely because I love God, I love my neighbor, right?
Positive feedback feels good.
Yeah.
You know, when people tell you you've done a good job, it feels good. And you want to do that. yeah. saying, that was pretty lousy. Yeah. You want to get that positive feedback. So yeah. you got to walk that line and make sure you don't get too prideful.
Right. Yeah. All right. Very good point. Does this make sense to you? Yeah? Any questions about any of this? I know I haven't gone the direction Jesus went with this. I've kind of been wandering a path. But I want us to see how these passages connect together. And really, this teaching here to examine ourselves and remove the log from our own eye, it kind of undergirds, you know, all of this. Why am I doing the things I'm doing to be a salt and light person? Why am I doing the things I'm doing in a public worship setting, or you know, doing things that I would say is for God's glory, right? And really covering all of life, too, all aspects of life. What's going on in my heart? And I need to be aware of that because we, as humans, we kind of share the same kinds of problems, right? It's nothing new between me and you. All right. Is that the final bell? All right. Thank you guys for your kind attention with this. Hope it was helpful.